Welcome to the Other F Word Podcast with Morgan,
Sarah,
and Melissa,
where we talk about that dreaded word, failure. Join us as we explore the messy, tragic, funny, and inspiring stories that make us human. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Other F Word Podcast. We are very excited to have Michelle Carlson on. She is the executive director of Teen Line, and we have a good friend of ours, mutual friends. We've never met. He's been telling me you got to come on the podcast for a long time, so it's good to meet you. Welcome. We're happy to have you here.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to be here.
So happy
are
to
you
have
honored?
You. I am honored. You've had some amazing guests. I feel honored.
We're kind of a big deal, Michelle.
You are.
But you are too. We're
honored. I'll get autographs later.
Yeah, it'll be all around, I think.
Well, tell us a little bit about Teen Line. What is Teen Line?
So Teen Line's an independent nonprofit that features a teen-to-teen hotline and community outreach service. So it's basically based on the premise that when teens need help, they usually reach out to a friend, right? But a lot of times, sometimes the issues that teens are dealing with, either they don't have somebody to actually talk to, or they just are embarrassed or ashamed for what they're experiencing. So maybe they don't want to tell a friend because maybe that might get around the school, or it might be shared in some way. Mm-hmm. So they're fearing about sharing it with someone. So it's basically based on that premise. And what it is the teen-to-teen hotline. We actually take about 100 teens a year and train them for about 65 hours on anything they could get a call about. So anything from gang violence to depression, suicide. And basically we put them on a hotline and they talk to other teens. So teens all around the world can call, text, or email our hotline any day of the week and talk to another teen about what they're experiencing.
That is so awesome.
And what do you look for in your teen volunteers?
That's a great question. You know, it's a number of different issues. I think we love to have teens who've been through their own struggles, right, and come out the other side. Because I think that they not only connect to callers, but I think that it provides a lot of hope. Like, I will get through this when you're talking to another caller.
Mm-hmm. So you guys offer a lot of supervision, kind of like
we
on-site
do, yeah.
while the kids are receiving phone calls.
Exactly, yeah. So actually, when the hotline is in session, we actually have mental health professionals there, not only to help them if they are struggling with a call, maybe it's a really difficult issue or maybe they're triggered by it, but also provide support to those volunteers after the calls because they can be so intense and so difficult.
Oh, that's so smart.
Yeah, we want to make sure that they're supported. Otherwise, they won't do well in terms of helping others.
What a powerful experience for like the caller and the receiver of the call.
Totally.
Wow. Yeah.
That's such a good philosophy in general. I think for you as a therapist, you take on a lot. So you need someone to kind of
I need someone to help me with everything I'm hearing.
You know, but I, well, mean,
I, but
good,
I do.
Yeah.
I do. I have supervisors. I have colleagues. I have my own therapist. I have my poor husband and mother who are also therapists. But yes, you do. If you're going to be the vessel for all of that emotional information, you have to be able to process it with somebody.
Absolutely. Yeah.
That's what amazes me, though, is that you're taking kids as young as 15. I mean, that seems really young to me. And yet, clearly, there are kids who have been through, sadly, a lot by that age. Mm-hmm. But it does seem almost optimistic. Maybe I'm just a pessimist, but that there would be kids who've already processed that stuff. Like,
yeah, I think there has been. I mean, either a lot of them have been into therapy if it's something really difficult in terms
right.
of trauma or something.
Right.
But yeah, a lot of them have. And I think that has to do too with, you know, the environment they're growing up in.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Talking about it with friends or talking about it with parents or
and having access
adult.
To it. Right?
Exactly. Yeah, having the access.
Yeah.
I think also it's amazing because I know in my practice, certain teens I work with, you can just tell that they're kind of old souls and they're wired for empathy and compassion and they like to help people. And so to give them a place to actually go and do that, where it's age appropriate.
Yeah.
You know, they're not taking care of an adult.
Yeah.
They're taking care of a peer.
Yeah.
Right.
And to kind of have that valued, I think is incredible because sometimes they don't know where to go. They don't really fit in when they're that older soul kind of,
right.
I've been
so
through a
true.
Lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kid.
Well,
yeah.
To that point, I think that that's what's the beauty of this program because it taps into that natural empathy you have and really kind of cultivates it, mm-hmm. and just developmentally where they're at.
Yeah.
I mean, right now they want more responsibility, yeah. right? They're trying on new yeah. identities. They're Love figuring that. Out what they stand for, what their values are. So we allow them, we give them the tools, we give them the responsibility, mm-hmm. but we do it in a way in which they're supported and it's a safe environment to do so. Mm-hmm. And so they thrive.
Oh, totally.
So we always tell people, you know, I think we really underestimate teens. It's for a matter sure. of giving so them the right tools and they run with it.
I mean, giving them that responsibility they raise to that. And also yeah. getting their mind off themselves, which... Yes. You know, it's such a so world true. Where you know, like,
they're
focus
so fucking
on
self-absorbed.
Yeah. 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 Which is
no,
so true.
No, it is. But, no, but it's developmental.
Right. Yeah. It's but true. It's exhausting and, yeah, right. frustrating.
Yeah.
Right. It's funny because as you're talking, I'm thinking, one of my daughters is that kid, and it's a, such a great quality. But the flip side of it is that she is extremely sensitive and, things like every little thing affects her because she's so attuned. She's so it's like her nerves are constantly at the surface of her body in every yeah. way. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And she will either make a really great teacher or therapist, but dealing with that as a parent is exhausting. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And you need so your own hotline.
I think she needs. I feel like I need my own hotline. No, but I feel like she would be the type of kid who would be really good for that because yeah. it's all the things you're saying. It takes their mind off themselves.
Yep.
It. Also puts things in perspective and yeah. like I think so much, and it also empowers them to feel like, oh my God, I can make a difference, I can do Absolutely. Something in this world, I can be of help to somebody else, and recognize that quality in themselves, the value, like value that empathy.
Absolutely.
Because I try to tell her that it's great that she's so empathetic and sensitive,
yeah,
which I was, you know, not told when I was growing up. And so I think, you know, and for, you know, for reasons that are understandable at the time, like a different generation and my, you know, parents had their own stuff. But, you know, I think it's such a great way to value that quality in kids.
Yeah.
And those types of kids.
It definitely is. And it helps them build, you know, build self-confidence, right?
Totally.
It encourages them that it's okay to reach out for help.
Yeah.
And I think it really talks to... that thought that it's okay to be vulnerable.
Right.
You know, yeah. I mean, I think so right. much of our society tells us, fix it, make it better, you can do more. And we just don't value who we truly are. And I think if we teach that at a younger age, that this is our God. Natural state is vulnerability, right?
Right.
We just don't always take that opportunity to be there. I mean, we all know when we're talking to someone, even if it's a friend or someone we just met, someone shares something deeply personal with us, what a connection that
yeah.
creates.
Yeah, we talk about that a lot.
And
yeah.
so, I mean, just them being able to do that to help their peers yep. is one of the most empowering things mm-hmm. That can occur. And which is why teens keep coming back to, you know, work on the shifts.
Right.
Well, it's amazing because it's the opposite of the culture they're living in, where it's all selfies and it's all this social media.
Yeah.
Look how great my life is. And it actually doesn't connect teens with each other. It makes other teens feel bad and disconnect. And so trying to get that word out that vulnerability is connecting. And yet it's not as glamorous, right? It's not yeah. as pretty as a bikini shot with your best friends,
yeah.
you know, by a pool, right, where that's what they're showing how much fun their life is. And yet the underbelly of that is just so much richer, and trying to get teens to yeah. to know to that.
And there's no and connection parents. In that. Like there's you yes. think you get some likes and it probably lasts a little bit and then goes right. away. There's really right. no depth to
there's
it.
There's no, it doesn't yeah,
you
last.
Just, it's yeah. this thing you have to keep true. Feeding to kind yeah. of, so okay, I get more likes,
right.
I get more likes.
It's right.
so true. Yeah. I was well, thinking exactly that. It's like shopping.
Yeah.
yeah.
You just have to get
yeah,
like it's a superficial just, fix, but
yeah, yeah, yeah.
it doesn't do kind of
And it's funny, that
problem.
Stuff we actually are scared to look at, if we look at it, that's actually how we connect with people.
Yeah.
When we bring that up, it's such a, but we're also scared.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know?
It's interesting when you talk to teens about that in social media, right?
Yeah, what do they say?
You know, it's they feel the pressure not only to keep up, right?
Yeah, there's so much
pressure. There's so much pressure. But I think it serves, they internalize it like it's a reflection of their social standing, right? Because, yeah. I mean, social media set up likes, shares, follows.
Ugh.
And so then you start doing that comparison and, you know, do I have enough likes? And so then they start to think, well, that's my social standing
and
in the
world.
How
could they not think that?
You know,
on some
they
level
should,
yeah. as a teenager
we
and you're in that world.
We should get rid of likes. We should just yeah. get rid of it. Wait, I think we just came up with something.
Yeah,
no, really.
It's yeah. What drives
I'm going to call Zuckerberg
it
right now.
Right now. Right?
I'll take care of that.
It drives anxiety, but I think it also drives the app, like the success of these apps. Like people go back because they, you know, that's what makes people go. And that's, they are addicting. But, you know, we were talking earlier before we started the interview about the inability of many kids these days to deal with failure.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, maybe you can speak a little bit about that and how, you know, the teen line both helps kids who on both sides, the volunteers and the kids who are coming to the teen line.
Yeah. I mean, we even see that in our own kids. We have, you know, obviously a self-selecting group of kids who want to help others. But even as part of their training, I was mentioning that we have role plays, which are kind of like mock calls, just to help get them comfortable with the practice of being on the line and how to handle a situation. And no one ever passes all of them. I mean, it's just impossible. They're not supposed to. It's supposed to be practice. But we've literally removed the word failure from that because there's such a sensitivity around that word to teens. And so we just say, you know, we're just going to have you redo this, practice it some more. And it goes over, it's the same meaning, right? But it just goes over in a different way, just based on how you're presenting it. But I think a lot of this lends itself to, you know, some of the changes in parenting styles too. I think the innate ability or innate want for any parent or adult is to protect kids, right?
Yeah.
We want to protect them from like emotional and physical harm. And so we like to fix things, right? We want to solve the problem, help them out. But unfortunately, it's like that kid that runs around the playground, falls down flat on their face. The parents run over before the kid is even processed or registered, kind of what's happened, right?
Yeah.
But I think we would do better service to that child by letting them fall, letting them kind of register what's going on, sitting in that discomfort, and then just saying, and then having the parents go over, right? So they start to think to themselves, okay, you know what? I went through this challenge. This is really hard. That hurt. But I know that I'll get through it because my parents have helped me get through it. And yet I'm able to stand on my own 2 feet. And that builds resilience. And I think that's key.
No, and I was listening to Dr. Drew has a radio show out here. I don't know if it's nationwide, but he was talking about, I guess he's doing some show with millennials or something. And he was saying how they have such a hard time with failure. Like they have no resilience. And he was saying how failure is good. We need to tell these kids failure is good.
We need to tell the parents failure is good, right?
Because
it's that trickle down. As you say, it's so uncomfortable for parents to let their kids struggle and sit in it. And
You're right. It's really
out.
The parents.
It's the parents.
Sorry,
really
parents. I mean, we're parents. I mean, we're not judging. We all
suck.
Do it. We all fucking do it. It's so hard. There's nothing harder than watching your child struggle and have despair and feel pain and... Mm-hmm. There's nothing better, I think, than actually being able to soothe them also. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't mean we don't soothe them. We can still soothe them, but they have to learn how to cope.
Well, yes. I always say, you know, it's so funny because, you know, your kids are at school and it's like your whole thing to be at school is to learn because you don't know it all.
Yep.
You know, so it is to fail and learn. That's the way you learn is by failing and processing and do it again, you know. So I think there's such an image of like, no, I've got it all figured out. No, none of us do, you know, we're all.
Yeah, but I feel like there are some kids who are more prone to that kind of pressure of needing to be perfect than others. Like, again, I'm talking about my kids again, but...
Thank God you have three.
Thank God I have three, and they're so fucked up. It's just endless things to talk about.
Maybe you should have some more.
I know, right? Yeah. Just for the podcast.
Yeah.
They're so not fucked up. They're great, and they're struggling, but in all the ways they should, I hope.
They're humans.
No, it's true, though, because your kids, immediately when they come out, they're different. You see, okay, this one...
They're so
this way, this one cares about this one because it doesn't care at all about that.
Well, it's head spinning as a parent, right? To have
it
kids
is.
That are so different.
And you think you have it down and then the next kid totally throws you. But my oldest daughter is so the classic first child and she is such a perfectionist.
Yeah.
It is. I'm like, where does this come from? And then the funniest thing is my youngest daughter is, I guess, in some ways, characteristically the third child. She thinks she is the greatest thing.
Right. In all her mess.
All her messy glory. Yeah. She is, you know.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of describe her as Animal from, or like Patty, Peppermint Patty. You know what I mean? Animal from the Muppets or Peppermint Patty. She's just like, she goes at life with full force. But, and she's not afraid to fail. So it's so, I think, reflective of... your wiring, which is, you know,
how comfortable you are with
failure. And so I imagine that you find that as well with you both, again, on both sides, with the teens who call and the teens who are helping out.
Definitely. I mean, I think that to create, and I think one of the things, you know, anybody can do is just creating a safe space to to fail, right? And creating a safe space to talk about
so
it.
True.
Can you say what they're talking about on these phone calls?
I mean, there's anything from, we get really the whole breadth of issues. So we can have a call as simple as, you know, I got in a fight with a friend, to I'm actively suicidal and I'm at the edge of the bridge. God. So there's, I mean, really a dichotomy between the severity of the calls. They're trained to be able to handle all of that. And I think, it's really amazing. I mean, they honestly connect with those callers in a way adults could never do. And you know, you look at them and say, I think people think, oh, well, they're just teens. How can they handle that? It's too heavy. It's too much. I'm telling you, they want the responsibility. I think you just do it in a supportive environment.
Again, well, you guys have set it up.
And so,
If a teen is actively suicidal, what do you guys do?
So they know how to assess. And if the person is not willing to get help, you know, if they're going to harm themselves, we'll usually send police out.
So you get their address.
We
ahead
do.
Of time.
We try to get as much information as possible up front.
Right.
And they're really savvy at doing that. I mean, just asking, you know, the caller's name, where do they go to school, to build connection,
that's
but
so
also
smart.
To sort of build a profile of that person in case we need to. Because someone can call about, oh, you know, I had a fight with a parent. But as they're peeling back the layers and the discussion gets deeper, they find out they're self-harming or they've been feeling suicidal.
Yeah.
So there's just a lot of shame that's hidden behind initially until they make that connection.
So what are some of the issues that come up? What are the most common ones that come up aside from suicide?
So relationships is our most common call, obviously, because that permeates all aspects of their life, right? And relationships are most important to them. The second is anxiety and stress, and we've actually seen that rise quite a bit. Third is depression. Fourth is suicide, and then fifth is self-harm.
Wow. So fourth and fifth are the more severe, but first, second, and third are kind of
more common.
I think that's really good for parents to hear that kids are not calling in about only the severe stuff. They're calling in about the common struggles of relationships and pressure.
Yeah, the everyday teen stuff.
That's what we want them to do, right? We want to go, we're trying to work farther upstream, right? Let's get them before they have a crisis. Let's teach them how to deal with these daily stresses and anxieties.
Right.
And then be able to manage that so it doesn't become a crisis.
Right.
What are kids expressing anxiety about? What's the anxiety about?
A number of different issues. I mean, I think a lot of, they feel overwhelmed, right? I mean, I don't know if you guys saw, there was a survey done by the American Psychological Association that asked teens, you know, how are they feeling? And 82% said they were moderately or extremely stressed. Kids are feeling really overwhelmed by sort of all the expectations of them, you know, keeping up with social media, all the activities they have to do, keeping their grades up, and then trying to sort of fit in, right? And
all
find themselves all at the same time.
And be extraordinary. I think, you know, we talk about that. All of a sudden, if you're a teen, you're supposed to have your own YouTube channel, or you're supposed to be, you know, a star and get over a 4.0. I mean, when was there an expectation for...
I
just heard of a kid who has a 4.4 that didn't get into UCLA.
And
it's like, when did that happen?
I know.
That's crazy.
There a certain age that you, for the callers, I mean, do you have to be a teenager or can you be younger?
Or can we call later? We're feeling down.
We have had parents call, actually.
I bet.
What do I do about my teen?
Right.
Yeah.
That's a whole other.
Yeah. So usually our callers are actually, we found over the last few years, are getting younger.
That doesn't surprise me.
We're talking 10, 12, as young as 10 and 12.
Yeah.
So that's not exactly what we were set up for, but we definitely accept the calls. And what we're finding is, you know, it's the same issues. So that's a good thing, I guess, in the sense that they're reaching out earlier for help.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe that's also a wake-up call because these issues are happening at a younger age.
And do you guys see a rise in, I mean, as the age goes younger, certain issues rising in
frequency?
Definitely. We definitely see anxiety and stress rising. Oh, it's gone off the charts.
Gosh, we keep hearing that over and over again. What do you think that's about? Do you have any sense?
I think it's a number of different issues. I think it's what we were talking about, sort of the resilience and the parenting difference in parenting. I think it has to do with social media. I mean, that's an easy thing to point out. But I think, you know, it's interesting. One of our team volunteers, which we call listeners because they listen and don't give advice, right? He was saying that, you know, we have all this social media to connect us, but yet we feel so disconnected.
That's what we hear all the time.
So disconnected.
I haven't met anyone too. I mean, I hate to say this, who wishes they'd grown up with social media who didn't.
I know.
Right.
So you know, like,
so true.
Yeah. I would be, I can't even think. Everything could be broadcasted to the world.
Oh,
there
yeah.
was no kind of personal space to fail.
Yeah.
Well, right? It changes connectivity, like you say. Yeah. You know, you're just connecting with people in different ways, but it's not as deep and it's not as, you know, so that's why I think it's good that you had the teen lines there too, because I don't know what it's like to be raised like that. You know, so my kid's going through stuff that I don't necessarily. I mean, I do a little bit, but, you know, I'm glad they have that as well to talk about.
Yeah, it's just it's another, we don't want it to replace, like, any long-term help they should be getting, right?
Yeah.
It's like a touch point. So what they do is, when a caller calls in, they just start talking, you know, to the person, what's your name, what school do you go to, you know, where's that located? And then they'll start asking them kind of open-ended questions. You know, what's going on tonight? Tell me more about that, that type of thing, to find out. And then they'll figure out with the caller, you know, what kind of options do you have? What can you be doing about this? Love teaching them coping strategies, maybe, you know, finding a website or chat, you know, a chat support room that they can go to, and then giving them those support resources so that they can be okay on their own. Because we don't want them continually calling back.
No, you want to. Well, and if there's something deeper, well, and it's good that they have the ability to tell, like, maybe dig a layer deeper to see what's really going on.
I remember when I was doing my training at Cedars, like 30 years ago, Elaine Leader, who started Teen Line.
Yes, our founder.
That's right. That's where Teen Line was. And it was, we would see all the kids come in. And it's been how long? How many years has
38
she?
38 years.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's awesome. Been known. I know. I know, Sarah. It's been, I was like four. But it's always been known in the community as this incredible resource that is so rare. Mm-hmm. Which you wouldn't think it would be so rare, but it is. She figured it out early on.
She did.
Way early on.
Yeah. Well, and the great thing is I feel like even though these kids are trained for the specific purpose, right, we're really just preparing them not only for life, but then they go out into the community and they become ambassadors of mental health in the community. So throughout, you know, beyond high school, they're kind of changing the way we view and talk about mental illness, which is really key. I mean, that's one of my passions too, because reducing some of that stigma is what keeps kids from getting help, keeps all of us from reaching out for help when we need it, right?
I love that. And on that, I wanted to know, so you said that's one of your passions. So what brought you to Teen Line, and kind of what was your journey getting to Teen Line?
So I've been in mental health for a number of years, and then I got really involved in suicide prevention, and that was due to my own losses to suicide prevention. Mm. So I've had four loved ones I've lost to suicide prevention, suicide, including my dad, who was a psychiatrist. So, I mean, that just shows how ingrained the stigma really is.
Yeah.
Did you know that he was suicidal?
No. I mean, I sensed there was something off. Of course, at that time, I wasn't fully educated on what to look for, some of the warning signs. But he was also very introverted and very quiet. And so he didn't talk a lot about how he was feeling.
And yet he was a psychiatrist.
I know.
Yeah, right?
Which is the irony of it all, right?
How old were you at the time?
This was 9 years ago. Yeah.
So
almost 10 years ago.
So when did you start at Teen Line?
I started suicide prevention, and then I went back to school, actually did a master's thesis in public health on suicide, mental health stigma and help-seeking behavior among adolescents. And so really started to see, you know, what causes teens to not reach out for help, what sort of demographics affect that. And so then,
so it really wasn't
the opportunity. Yeah, right, yeah. Because right. I felt like, you know, we're trying to change the mindset of the general public, which is sometimes really hard as adults. You know, we have the way we grew up or the way we're living our lives. It becomes a repeated pattern, and we can try to do that. But what better way to do that than to start young, right?
Absolutely.
Especially with that domino effect, because those these kids we're sending out now that have been trained are in their communities. They're the ones in colleges where they have such high suicide rates, where they're going to start that conversation and say, what's going on? Mm-hmm. I noticed that you're not doing okay. Tell me what's happening.
Right.
And the four loved ones that in your life that took their life, were they adults?
They were all adults.
They were all adults.
Yeah. One was a college student. One of my fellow college students. Yeah.
And with the others besides your dad, did you see warning signs?
At that time, because my dad was the most recent loss. Mm-hmm. At that time, I wasn't fully aware. Mm-hmm. I think with my college friend, I did see warning signs. I don't think that I realized what it was or the severity of them, mm-hmm. I guess, mm-hmm. Where we did get her in to help, but it was just
too late.
She was just at a point where, you know, I think, and I'm sure you guys understand, suicide is one of those things where it's hard for people to understand, how could that be a choice, right? Yeah. How can that be an option on the table? Right. But I think for people who die by suicide, I think they just want to escape that pain. Right. They're like, get me out of this painful place. I can't take anymore.
It actually creates hope.
Yes.
Right? If you've talked to people who have tried to kill themselves, they will say there's often this flight into health right before they make an attempt, because they finally have hope that there's relief of their pain.
Yes.
And so it's really tricky. It's very seductive.
Would you say there's a flight into
health?
Like, explain that.
You could have a kid or an adult who's struggling with deep depression, mm-hmm. and then they decide they're going to kill themselves, and they have a plan. And that's the flight into health. All of a sudden, they feel hopeful.
So
they feel a relief from their symptoms. They feel happy. They might connect with people. There's a joy because there's relief in sight. And it's very tricky because if you talk to family members, and you could speak more about this, I'm sure, family members feel so blindsided by it because they'll say, but she was so happy and we just had dinner
and
she just called me because there's
heard of that.
Yeah, it's not with everybody, but it is very common. And
well, it makes sense with what you hear people before. Now, does sometimes that create an opening to not do it because they're feeling better in some sense?
I think if there's a healthy enough piece, right? Or you feel like a real connection, or you latch onto something that creates more sustainable hope.
Absolutely.
Right?
I think if there's that ambivalence still there, which most people are, I mean, we even see it with the teens that call our line that are suicidal. There's a lot of ambivalence about it.
Yeah.
So it's an opportunity, I think, for anybody that when you're seeing someone in distress for a significant amount of time, is to just even ask them that question, you know, are you thinking about suicide?
Yeah.
We teach parents to do that, when they don't know when to decipher kind of when should I worry, right? Yeah. It's just asking that question, as uncomfortable as it is.
Oh my God, it's so hard to ask.
You know, it's funny because we actually had a woman on our show who talked about, she's a suicide survivor, and she talked about how important that question was. And she said that a lot of the time parents will think that they're putting the idea into their kids' heads if they ask it. And she's like, no, it's addressing it. It's addressing the elephant in the room, and they want you to ask. Or, you know, as kids who are going through that, or people going through that, want it addressed. They want you to ask them. Yeah. So that's interesting.
It is weird. It is another F word.
Seriously.
It's so cloaked in shame, right?
Cloaked in shame.
And so when you ask that question, it's like the burden is lifted off that person. Like, oh my gosh, this person is allowing me to talk about it.
Right.
It just takes the burden
off. But
then
what I've experienced in family therapy is it's lifted off of the child, which is a good thing, but it's put onto the parent.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where a lot of adults don't ask, because it's like, I don't know what to do, right? So that's where we always say, you don't have to know what to do.
Exactly.
You need help, right?
Professional.
Professional. Because it's huge. It's a huge elephant in the room that most people don't know how to navigate.
Very true. And we always tell parents that, you know, just because you ask doesn't mean that now you have to be the mental health professional.
Right. Yeah.
Please don't do that, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But you could feel like such a failure.
As
a parent.
And so from your experience, were they all back to back? Like, how did you get through that? How was that for you? And
a lot of therapy.
Yeah. Thank God for therapy.
Really. Yeah. I mean, I think there's no way you can navigate that kind of trauma
without.
Especially because, you know, it's not, it's, I you know, I was really lucky. I went to like a support group with suicide survivors. And so it was great to be able to talk about it with people who've had similar losses. Like, as we talked about, just making that connection, right? Because it's just a roller coaster of emotions. Because like you said, I mean, I think everyone feels like they've been blindsided. Because what happens is the suicide, the act of suicide itself, completely overshadows who that person was, what they stood for, the memories. So, you know, unfortunately, people are remembering people for the one act, right? Yes. Instead of for who they were as a person. So it makes it really difficult to kind of navigate those emotions and figure that out. But and
probably a lot of guilt and anger.
Yeah,
and
you go through a number of different things.
Right.
Yeah.
Resentment or,
Or did you feel like a failure as a daughter? Like I should have.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Because even though I wasn't doing suicide prevention, I was still in mental health. Yeah. Like, how did I not know this? Right. It was right under my nose.
Right.
Yeah. That was probably one of the more difficult things to address.
Right. Yeah. There's just, I mean, suicide is such a classic case of, it's such a metaphor in some ways for the failure. There's so much failure in it, I guess, you know, failure in terms of, you know, an ability to address these issues that lead people to suicide, people feeling like a failure if they don't successfully complete suicide, failure on the part of people who, you know, feel they couldn't help. Mm-hmm. Like it's, and shame, I think at the bottom of it all is so much shame aloneness, I imagine, and lack
absolutely.
Of, you know,
The show, 13 Reasons Why.
Yes, which is now in its second season.
I
know.
I just watched it last weekend.
The second season.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Well, I think, I mean, it's so controversial on so many levels. I'm curious what you think, but the way they depicted the parents and the pain that the parents endure and continue to, I thought was really powerful.
Yeah,
you know, and
in
obviously
the second season or the first?
I haven't seen the second season. The first season, and the pain of everybody afflicted.
Yeah,
you know?
And that carries on into the second season. Yeah. I think.
What did you think? There is a lot of controversy.
Yeah.
Do you think it glorified suicide?
I really do. Yeah.
Really.
I think the suicide prevention community all feels pretty united in terms of the response.
That's what you hear,
Like it's permission.
Yeah. Well, I think the way that they did it, they didn't have to show it. Right.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, I don't, if you guys saw it, that scene is just, they even asked teens after the fact, they did a research study, and the majority of teens said they felt it was too graphic.
It was too graphic for me. I'm an adult.
It was hard to watch. But they showed after, you know, that graphic act that she looked very peaceful.
Yeah.
And I think that that could be really misleading. And then they also, you know, they showed the locker. So she was being revered. She was more popular in death than in life.
Yep. That's
so
the thing I always got is when everybody's talking, all of their lives are focused around her.
Yep. Yeah.
Yes.
So if you're not feeling her, then all of a sudden everybody's lives is all about her at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was just like, that's an interesting.
And there's
she wasn't there.
Except she wasn't there, exactly. Yeah. But as the teenage brain, I just wonder how capable it is of of putting that together.
Not. Yeah.
Right? Well, really understanding it on a deep level.
Absolutely. I mean, we know, right? We've got like, we can have perspective where we can say, okay, this is just a show, right? But for kids, you know, at that developmental age, right? Their emotions are like untethered.
Yes.
They're feeling emotions. Yes. They don't have that regulation.
Yeah, totally.
So when you're seeing something like that, it's really more difficult to sort of process it.
It feels really real. I watched it. I binged watch it when I had the flu. That's kind of the only way to watch it when you're already in physical pain. but I felt like it was real. You feel like you're in their lives. And so it's really, I could see how
powerful.
If I'm a teen in pain, feeling desperate, feeling alone, it was seductive.
Yeah.
And yet what I have found as a parent, because I have a 15-year-old and he saw it. And so we got to talk about all of it.
That's good.
And I treat teenagers in family therapy in my practice is it did open up a conversation that's really necessary about suicide and about how not to go there, right? If we could learn anything from it, it's what you just said. Like, let's not glorify it. Let's not, let's try to learn from it.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. We got I don't know if you saw the email from school, Morgan, that went out, or maybe it just was for the high school students. I don't know. We got an email from the headmaster of my kid's school, and it was addressing the new season and saying, it was saying that this is coming out and we want to give parents the heads up, and that this season at least comes with a bunch of resources apparently that they have questions to ask, and you know, resources to, you know, places to reach out to. Yeah.
Teen Line.
Teen Line. Yeah. Does it? I don't know if it's
sponsored by Teen Line.
We're working on it. Yeah.
Seriously. And so, you know, they urged parents to use it as an opportunity to have conversations.
Yeah. That's amazing that your school,
it's amazing that the school does that.
You know, I think schools need to get more involved.
They do.
I think there is a failure in terms of schools not getting more involved.
Yeah.
Because they have so much access.
Yeah. And I think it's important to remind, I think in the first season, if you remember, I think it's important to remind the kids that there is hope. I think that's one of the things that we criticized in the first season, is every adult that Hannah turned to, the main character, failed her.
Oh,
right? Like the school counselor, the parents. And so, you know, it doesn't encourage kids to reach out for help. Oh, so we have to constantly remind it. So it's good that it starts a conversation because it allows us the opportunity to talk about these tough issues because kids want to talk about them.
They want to talk.
And here's the thing, and we always talk about this, and I think it's a failure that all of us parents experience, is that we get really distracted and really stressed and we don't slow down and notice our kids' cues. And sometimes they're really fucking obvious, like fall on the floor in a big tantrum. And sometimes it's really subtle, like a pulling on mom, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever it is, I think we as adults have to start to slow down and listen to what our kids are saying. Because that was one of the most painful parts of the show that was such a failure, is that she did try. Yeah. She did try and the adults
failed
missed
her.
It. They did.
And as we also talk a lot about in our podcast, it takes, you really only need one person. If you have one person you can connect with and who's there for you, that goes such a long way, at least in terms of preventing, I think, or you know, holding off, staving off the suicide.
Yeah.
But you also mentioned earlier in an email that suicide is the number one killer. Is that, it's sort of like a health epidemic at this point, more so than gun violence?
Yeah.
Can you speak a little bit about
that? Yeah. So, you know, we talk about gun violence, which is awful. What's been happening with the school shootings. It's just tragic and shouldn't happen. But I think what overshadows it is the amount of people lost to suicide by a firearm. It's actually substantially more.
That's crazy.
So if you think about it, I mean, we're losing around 45,000 people a year. I mean, that's like an epidemic to suicide. So it's something that isn't talked about. But yet what we find is, even when we train our teens and even when we do trainings of teachers, is we ask the question, have you had suicidal thoughts or known anybody who has? And every single person raises their hand.
Oh, God.
So why is it that we can't talk about it?
Well, it's so interesting. We have one of our past podcast, Brian Bihar, he talked about how his father killed himself and nobody knew that he was struggling with a lot of failure. And he was so ashamed. He had lost all of his family's money. And and that we were saying that failure is not an option, but suicide is.
Mm.
And there's something really wrong with that, which is part of why we wanted to start this podcast and continue it. To take all that quiet, private shame out and be able to talk about it, so that suicide, something so final and permanent, is not an option.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it's so crazy making that that's actually more prevalent.
And,
you know,
and I think everybody can have a role in it. They don't have to go out to a suicide prevention walk or whatever.
Right.
I think if everyone can just, it starts with listening.
Yeah.
Right.
That's what something I was going to ask. Like, what do parents look for in general or listen
what do you
for?
Tell?
Yeah. Well,
what
I think, one of the things, just if it can take away anything from what I've said today for parents or even adults, is just to listen. And it's, you know, like the Buddhists call it compassionate listening, right? Not just listening to understand, but listening to help ease that person's pain or their burden. Mm-hmm. Because that's what it does when you listen.
Yeah.
And I think it's things. So, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, so like listening not to fix and not trying to fix, but listening to just be there.
Well, it's hard because it triggers our anxiety and fear as a parent.
Yeah, totally.
Of we better do something.
Yeah. You know? But I think even just sitting with someone in their pain, particularly adolescents, right?
We say that.
So just, you know, sitting there listening, even if it sounds absurd, right? Because they have a lot of emotions. There's a lot of changes going on. They're figuring out who they are. Just sitting there and listening and being open and validating what they have to say, no matter if you understand it or not.
Right.
You know, that sounds things like that sounds really hard. Tell me more.
Yeah.
It's just an opportunity for them to feel validated and heard, because we hear that from our teens all the time is, I just don't feel understood. I just don't feel heard. I don't feel validated. Yeah. Like my opinion really matters because I'm young.
Right. But so that's all they want. That's all they need, really.
That's all everybody needs in a way. Like, we all want to be heard and validated and, you know. And
well, we talk about that all the time, that everybody just wants to feel like they're enough.
Yeah.
That they're good enough, right? And teens are at the most vulnerable age developmentally to, to not feeling that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Right. So it's so simple.
Yeah. And I love that compassionate listening thing. I heard somebody say, it was in a religious context, but it was like, our job is to relieve people's burdens, not to tie them up or not to bind them up. And I was like, wow, that's really, because I think sometimes from a religious standpoint, you can just add burdens onto people.
Right.
Like, you're not doing this.
Yeah.
But I think it was an Episcopalian shout. No, but it was to unbind. To unbind those burdens, not to bind them up. And I love that. I think a lot of that is just listening, just letting them, you know. Because love's the thing that loosens those things, you know, ultimately.
Absolutely. And I think conveying that to someone, you know, through eye contact, leaning forward, you know, asking open-ended questions to allow them to really delve into what's going on, you know, clarifying their feelings. I think a lot of times, especially adults do this with teens, is we assume, oh, well, this is how I would react to that.
Right.
So it sounds like that must have really made you mad. And they're like, not at
all.
You know? Yeah. So I think it's important to check yourself. Yeah. And when you talk, it's just clarifying what they're feeling. You know, it sounds like those types of statements. Yeah. And allowing them to really navigate the conversation.
Yeah. I love compassionate listening. That's going to stay with me. You know, because I think what you were saying too is like, we're so busy as parents. Mm-hmm. You know, we're also in such a busy world to actually. So even when we listen, it's kind of like, I'm listening,
like,
but I'm thinking about this over here.
Right,
I'm still doing this over here, but I'm trying to be a good parent in here.
Right.
Well, one thing my mom always did with my brother and I, and I do with my kids, and I suggest in my practice, is this idea of special time. And I think it's easy to let go of when your kids get older, but the idea is you spend time together where you put your phones away. And the kid gets to decide what you do.
Yep.
Right? And you're not teaching and you're not spending money and you're not on the computer. Although teens might say, I want to show you my favorite YouTube videos, and that's okay. But, you know, I think we all forget that teens need that because they're separating from us. So they just want to be with their friends. But if I think you make it a normal part of your family, like a value where we need special time. And
How often do you do it?
I mean, it depends on the week, but I try at least once a week. With I think when kids are younger, it's easier to do it more often. Yeah. And I think when kids are in a crisis or struggling, they need it more often. And what I've asked my kids to do is to ask for it sometimes as a coping mechanism.
Yeah,
so and that my mom taught me that. And it's like the very thing that can fill up a kid. And yet it's we forget that that we have that to offer.
Totally.
It's connection.
Yeah,
you
it's
know?
Connection. Yeah.
And we're not, it's not fix it time.
Yeah.
It's really just following their lead.
Because I try to do that, but I generally like will say, well, let's go do this. I don't really say...
Well, they get to be because the idea is they get to be in control.
Yeah,
they get to be in control of and that's because they don't feel in control most of the time.
So true,
right? And so they get to be in control, and we have to deal with our own control issues
and in a safe way, by the way, because giving kids too much control is also scary and overwhelming.
Right.
So don't let my 9-year-old drive to. To where we're going.
I forgot there are parameters for safety. Okay. Hopefully you have instincts about that.
I love that though, because it sends the message to them that what they have, like what, that they're important.
That they matter.
Their decisions matter,
And who they are matters.
And so it makes them think more about, even though that's not, you know, developmentally where they're at, but it makes them calculate that a little better.
Yeah. It's incredible. And it really fills up the parents too. I mean,
there's
nothing better than having that kind of time with your kid, especially when your kid's acting out.
Yeah.
That's when they need it more.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it's counterintuitive because you think, oh, you know, go to your room or, you know, you're in trouble, but they actually need more connection.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how Teen Line working there has maybe helped you sort through some of your pain maybe and whatever, I guess, you were experiencing after the loss of all these people who are close to you. How has it helped you?
It's helped me immensely. I'm not just, you know, growing. I've taken my pain and I've used it to try to help other people, right?
Yeah.
That's part of my healing. And yeah. I know that works for me. It doesn't work for everybody. But I've met a number of different people within suicide prevention mm-hmm. who have their own losses. And yeah. they find that that's what heals them. Because it gives them an opportunity to talk about, like, we have parents that we work with that go in the community with us to talk about the loss of their son or daughter. And it helps not only keep that memory alive of them, but it takes away the shame of suicide and not defining that person by that mm-hmm. one final act, right? For me, I've learned immense amounts. I feel very lucky. I'm in an environment where I'm constantly challenged and I'm always learning from the teens. And that to me is a gift,
right? Yeah.
To be able to learn so from great. Young people and, yeah. and the yeah. way yeah. they think and how they view the world. And to be part of that, helping them prepare totally. Them for the mm-hmm. world and give them additional tools and, yeah. and help empower them is really helpful for me.
That's so great.
My growth yeah. too.
Incredible. What a gift. And so I know my son has done research to go to the training and be a part of Teen Line.
Oh, great.
If other kids are interested in applying and or calling, right? Either being a listener or a caller, what do you suggest?
So you can they can call the hotline between 6 and 10 any night of the week and talk to another teen, and that's 800-TLC-TEEN.
Right.
Or they can text 839-863. Nice. They can text teen to that number. Or they can go to our website. There's a number of different resources. We have like online chat rooms with specific specific issues. Awesome. So they can talk to other people who've been through some of those issues. We have, I think, over 32,000 teens on there currently. Wow. We have teen blogs, several resources. We even have a parent website for support, and you can find all that information at www.teenlineonline.org.
Mm, so
awesome.
Good.
That's and we'll put
so
that great. In the, the show notes.
Thanks.
And if you want to do the training, you go to the website as well.
Yes. So if you want to do the training, we do 3 training groups a year, and they can go on there and sign up, and we will notify them when the next training opportunity is.
That's awesome. Awesome. Great.
Yeah.
That's the one my son did. Maybe he called the hotline. I'm not sure. But. Oh,
it's great. That's
my mother's driving me crazy. Here I am again.
Wait a minute. That sounds oddly familiar.
I know that kid.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Other F Word Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review our podcast, and visit us online at theotherfwordpodcast.com. You can also find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And we'd love to hear your stories of struggle with failure. You can contact us at info@theotherfwordpodcast.com. See you next time.